Welcome to the ITAM Review Podcast, news, reviews and resources for ITAM, SAM and software licensing professionals.
Hi everyone, welcome to this latest ITAM Review Podcast, and joining me today I have got Dean Bolton from License Fortress. Hi Dean.
Hello all, thank you Rich.
And I have got Tim Gorman from Bridgeton Data. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all good, thank you. It's great to have you both with me. So today, we're going to be talking about a fantastically interesting, sticky, thorny. So we're going to be talking about Oracle in the cloud, specifically Oracle in Microsoft Azure. You know, we see when we do the ITAM Review Wisdom conferences in North America, in Europe, in APAC, there are always questions about this kind of thing. You know, most people have Oracle to some degree. Most people are using Azure to some degree. So it sort of stands to reason that at some point, a lot of people will consider or be asked about merging the two of them. You know, can we put Oracle on Azure? Should we put Oracle on Azure? What about Oracle OCI? All these kind of things. So these are questions that we hear, and I think that hopefully between you, we will come to some kind of agreement by the end of this podcast. So for those of you listening, the idea is we're going to try and address some of the misconceptions, some of the myths, the concerns, so that you leave us with a more solid idea about what you can and can't do. So with that, I will get us started, and I think, you know, probably the first place is, you know, can you put Oracle on Azure at all? You know, what are the kind of situations where you can and can't? And yeah, I'll let you choose who goes first on that one.
Sure. So the short answer, and we'll make this podcast really quick, is yes, done. Okay. So what else do we have to talk about?
Well, thank you very much for coming.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody. It was fantastic. So the short answer is yes, you can. But there's a lot of nuances in there. And I think there's still a lot of misconceptions out there around running Oracle workloads in Azure. And hopefully we can address those from a licensing perspective, a support perspective, a technical perspective during the course of this podcast. From a licensing perspective, at a very high level, there is nothing in your Oracle contract that would prevent you from moving your workloads wherever you see fit, including Microsoft Azure. Azure is a fantastic platform, lot of advantages as a public cloud in terms of being able to be very dynamic and address scalability, elasticity, et cetera, issues in there. And your Oracle workloads can fit right into that. I've been working with Oracle for 25 years now as an enterprise architect for about 15 years, focused on license compliance in there. And there is nothing in the hundreds of Oracle contracts that I've reviewed over that time that limits you to where you run those workloads, right? So Azure is a perfectly acceptable place. Now, Oracle does have a licensing guide for how you do the licensing in the authorized cloud providers, of which Azure is one. And so that can be beneficial too, because in Azure, as everyone technical is probably aware, you're not really sure what the underlying hardware is. That's the whole point of kind of public clouds, is that you provision the resources that you need from an instance level. And the cloud provider takes care of the technical underpinnings to give you those resources. With the cloud policy that Oracle has, they allow you to look at just the virtual resources for your licensing needs in there. And that can be very advantageous for customers in terms of how they do it, right? So if you only need a small footprint in there, and I'm sure Tim's going to talk about right sizing in a second, but if you need a small footprint, that's all you have to provision, that's all you have to license. And so it opens up a lot of possibilities and flexibility for customers when they move their Oracle workloads into Azure or deploy new Oracle workloads in Azure.
Agreed. Oh, sorry. Well, let me jump right in. As Dean was mentioning, there are many different aspects of looking at running Oracle on Azure, licensing, technical, other aspects. Dean has addressed the licensing aspects. I'll address some of the technical aspects. A lot of the Oracle community, they look at Azure and they say, yuck. Why would I run my Oracle workloads on Azure? Well, for the first reason, just about every IT estate, every organization is running a mixture of different types of software. They're running SQL Server, they're running Sybase or whatever it's, you know, SAP ASE. They're running a variety of different types of software, including Oracle. And usually Oracle's right at the center of it. It's the hub of the organization. So when they're moving to the cloud, you know, they're probably moving a lot of their SQL Server to Azure, but what about Oracle? Well, Oracle should be moving to Azure as well, as being at the hub of their organization as well. There's nothing wrong with running, there's actually everything in favor of moving Oracle to that Azure environment as well. A lot of people think that Azure is all about Windows. I mean, it's Microsoft after all, isn't it? The fact is that really Azure is about 65 and growing, 65% Linux. You know, it's not really just all about Windows. It's mainly Linux and et cetera. It's a very, very, very highly performant piece of architecture there. So it's a wonderful cloud, as you'll find out. The other thing that starting to lose a little bit of what I was saying. But the other thing that should be understood about Oracle running on Azure is that it's kind of lost in as far as the companies are concerned. What I mean by that is nobody except the customers really want Oracle to run on Azure. Let me explain. Oracle, of course, really wants everything to run on Oracle Cloud. They want all the Oracle database workloads to run on Oracle Cloud, and they're going to push towards that. Microsoft, to be honest, really doesn't care about Oracle workloads running on Azure. They actually want you to run something like Azure SQL or Azure Postgres or some other kind of Azure Cosmos, you know, DB. They want you to run one of their packages on Azure. They're not all that enthusiastic about you running Oracle on Azure. So they're going to push you towards one of those other packages. But because Oracle is at the center of your IT estate, it's the hub, and you know everything else is a spoke, it's the customers who are pushing to run Oracle on Azure. And all I can say is keep doing that, because again, Oracle runs wonderfully on Azure. And it really is well worthwhile, well worth the effort to move Oracle to Azure. So just like running on other clouds, the type of resource that you want to run Oracle within Azure would be a memory-optimized compute resource, memory-optimized VM. We've got multiple types of VM, mostly the slightly smaller E-type memory optimized and M type. We've got multiple types of storage ranging from low end, rather inexpensive storage to very high end, either Azure NetApp files or Silk type storage. So a variety of different types of storage differing in performance and other features. So I think I'm going to halt right there for now. Dean, did you have anything else to add?
I mean, I think that's a great summary on both points there, from the licensing perspective and the technical perspective. So I think that's a good one in there.
It's a big. I'll circle back just for a second to that point that I made earlier. Oracle and Microsoft themselves aren't all that enthusiastic about people running Oracle on Azure. I know that there's a partnership in progress with having Exadata's running on Azure, and they're very enthusiastic about that because they both stand to make a lot of money from that partnership. I think partly what we're talking about, Dean, is we're talking about just running your regular Oracle workloads, not necessarily Exadata, but just taking your Oracle workloads and moving them to an Azure, VM running on Azure storage, just regular, without Exadata.
That's a great point, Tim, in there. And I think that is a good call. I think the biggest thing is just customers now have so many different options in there to pick and choose what best fits their needs in there. Yeah. And that's a business need, an operational need, and a financial need, right? I have a budgetary requirement in there. I think the partnership between Azure and Oracle is a very interesting one. And the Exadata at Azure is an interesting option as well. It can be a great option for customers, but Exadata to me is oftentimes a Ferrari, right?
Yeah, and very high end.
I don't always need a Ferrari to go down the street to the grocery store in there. And I don't want to pay for a Ferrari to go down the street to the grocery store either.
What Oracle will argue is that what they're doing is that they're creating a fractionalized environment on the Exadata there. They're creating a virtualized Exadata so that you can go from a very low end environment. But we know that's not the case. You're not going to be just buying a little fraction of an Exadata. The truth is that with Oracle, you can put Oracle on a very small VM within Azure and then range up to a pretty large environment within Azure, at which point you can then deal with the partnership between Oracle and Microsoft to work with Exadata. So we have quite the range of possibilities of running Oracle within Azure. You can just work on your own, or you can work with the partnership. So just be aware of that. One other thing to be aware of, the partnership has just started. It just started at the end of last year and the beginning of this year. Right now, it's only in the East US region, Washington, DC, and it's rolling out to London, Germany, and the West US for the rest of the year 2024. And then it's going to spread out globally. So be aware of that progression around the globe for that Exadata type deployment. The other thing too is that as the year 2025 and 2026 progresses, it's also going to move to other clouds. That Exadata partnership, Oracle is planning to move to AWS and Google and other, I don't know about the Google thing, but AWS, they're planning, the Azure partnership is just the beginning. So be aware of that. But we're talking about running Oracle on Azure. There is always that. You can always run Oracle on Azure. So we've got a really great progression from the smallest, one or two vCPU environment all the way up to the big Exadata environments.
Cool. So we've got some fantastic information there. And I think, for many people listening, that will be kind of, brand new information to some extent. So I'm just thinking, from a asset management, licensing, procurement perspective, if you're an asset manager within a large organization, as many of the listeners will be, is this something that is going to, if it comes onto your radar, is it going to be, Oracle going to come to you and talk about it? Are Microsoft going to bring it to you, or is it going to be something that will come internally? So it will be your cloud migration team or your database team. Just thinking, where should people be looking to see if this idea pops up?
There have been over the years a lot of different proposals. Back in 2019, the first proposal that came across was something called the Cross Cloud Interconnect, a partnership between Microsoft and Oracle. And that was where Microsoft and Oracle, realizing that they had between Azure and OCI, they actually had cloud centers that were pretty much across the parking lot from one another at different points around the world, specifically Washington, D.C., you know, in Ashburn, Virginia, San Jose, you know, a couple different places, three or four different points in the U.S., one up in Toronto. So they actually strung wires. But anyway, they set up the cabling to do this cross-cloud interconnect. And then they said, hey, you can connect your clouds. And you can connect your applications here. They went a little bit overboard with that. By 2022, they said that you could actually connect, say, a PeopleSoft application with the front end of the PeopleSoft application in Azure and the back end database in OCI. They were telling people you could do that. Same thing with eBusiness Suite. Same thing with JD Edwards. They were actually telling people you could do that. Now, it didn't work out. It failed horribly. But what people could do is connect, say, two applications to one another and do ETL back and forth between them. Say a data warehouse over here in OCI and a PeopleSoft application in Azure. That worked great. But the latency between the two data centers to split up an application like PeopleSoft with the front end and the back end, that was far too much. But the latency between two applications, that's just fine. But, you know, within an application, no good. So they've got good ideas. But beware of somebody who tries to come across with that strange little cross-cloud application within an app, you know, cross-cloud, sorry, interconnect within an application. That might still be flying around out there, you know, because, again, both companies were trying to push that as recently as 2022. I think they've pretty much given up on that. And the whole Exadata within Azure thing was a reaction to that. You know, forget about having Exadata in OCI and the front end in Azure. Let's just put the Exadata in Azure, which was the correct, you know, fix for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there were some silly ideas is what I'm saying, and they've been fixed. You know, the two companies are smart. You know, every once in a while, a bad idea comes around. And the cross-cloud interconnects are still there. And they've got their good uses. Again, if you have a data warehouse in, you know, or you know, a BI system in OCI and the front-end system is in Azure, you've got that cross-cloud interconnect right there for that fast data transfer. That's wonderful. But don't try to split an application across that. That's bad. I mean, for the most part, it's bad.
I think that segues perfectly into kind of where these come from, right? Because I think the companies have realized that going across the cloud for anything that has, you know, high volume, low latency, not a great idea. And as you said, the Exadata at Azure is a response to that. But I think, Rich, it's still a lot of internal confusion when customers are migrating to the cloud around some of these options that can lead to looking at something like that where you're doing cross cloud. And I think one big point that I hope people take away from this is that you don't really need to silo your environments like that anymore. You can move your entire Oracle stack to Azure just like the rest of your environment. They shouldn't be treated separately. You have to be careful in there and do right sizing, because with everything cloud, if you're not careful with it, you can end up overpaying, right? There's a whole new term around FinOps, right? Around managing your cloud spending in there, and that comes into it. But I think it's kind of a lot of this comes out from customers who are trying to migrate to the cloud, get confused around how these things work and end up siloing those workloads. And I think, you know, my number one takeaway is going to be, you don't have to do that. Don't silo those workloads. Make the decision that fits best and move everything together so that you're addressing the business as a whole.
Right. I'm with you. And is it usually licensing concerns that play a part in that, you know, where people think, right, I've got all this Oracle software. I can see the logic of, yep, I can put all this in Oracle OCI on shouting at me and making me pay millions of dollars. That makes sense. But then I can't see how they're going to let me do the same thing in Azure or AWS. So it's probably safer if I keep my Oracle and Oracle and my Microsoft and Microsoft. Is that how organizations tend to think about these things at the moment?
I think so. And yeah. I think some of it is also the respective vendors' sales teams kind of push that too, right? it's keeping it that way makes it easier for them and they're incentivized that way. But I think from a licensing perspective, a contractual perspective, there's no reason to do that, right? There's definitely some technical things that I think Tim is waiting to kind of jump in on in there and some confusion around that. But from the licensing perspective, it's about making good decisions and right-sizing your environment. But there's nothing that really prohibits you from moving those Oracle workloads into Azure if that's your desired cloud provider.
There's a little bit of back explanation that's needed here. Back in the 1990s, when Oracle first came up with processor-based licensing, do you remember the kerfuffle about that? Mm-hmm. It still goes on to this day. Everyone's like, you're kidding me. You're going to license my processors even though I'm not using them all? Yes. Well, back around then, right around then, Oracle came to try and take the sting out of that. Oracle came up with something called the processor core factor table discount. If you're using Intel-based processors, you get a 50% discount on that processor-based licensing. So right about 2016, Oracle said, you know, everyone got used to that. Great. You know, you're using Intel-based processors. You get 50% off. Great. Well, right about 2016, Oracle said, well, if you're using Intel-based processors in the cloud, AWS and Azure, you don't get that discount. So when you're counting up your VMs in AWS and Azure, you don't get to apply that 50% discount. So from that denial of that discount in the cloud, arose this myth about, well, Oracle is twice as expensive outside of Oracle Cloud, because of course they kept that 50% discount in OCI. They just took it away on AWS and Azure. So be aware of this. When you're starting to size in AWS and Azure, you can't use that 50% discount. Of course, you can use it in OCI, or Oracle includes it in OCI. So this is what Dean is saying about right sizing. You got to make sure when you're migrating from on-prem into the cloud that you choose the right number of processors. And that may not be a one-for-one from your on-prem environment into the cloud. If you're running, say, VMware on-prem, and you're using 32, let's say a 32-core system on-prem, it doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to use 32 cores in Azure. An equivalent system on Azure. What you want to do is you want to measure using one of the Oracle workload reports, either StatsPak or AWR. You want to measure how many average active sessions your on-prem system is running on-prem. Average active sessions. There's no, there's something else. Oracle's been very careful on their on their workload reporting to never have a metric that says this is your CPU, active CPU utilization. They don't have such a metric that says that, obviously, because someone's going to, you know, immediately file a support call that says, wait a minute, I licensed 100 CPUs and I'm only using 3 according to this metric. So they don't have a metric that says that. The closest thing, in my opinion, is this metric in AWR or StatsPak, it's called average active sessions. Look for it. So look for average active sessions, which is the closest thing to active CPU, and use that as the basis for choosing the amount, the size of a VM in the cloud. Use that as the basis. And don't use that as the actual metric necessarily, but use it as the basis for right sizing, and use that to, you know, size your cloud environment. And you'll find that your on-prem environment is generally far oversized.
Yep. Right. So I'm just thinking, so with that then, you know, again, for the people with us, you know, if you're renewing your Oracle, you know, whatever kind of agreement it might be, or if you're talking to Microsoft about, you know, moving Oracle into the cloud, is this something that you can only really do at renewal? You know, if there's a scenario where, you know, you're probably over licensed if you're moving into the cloud, you know, is this something, if you're partway through an agreement, can you turn around to Oracle and say, oh, we're moving to Azure, we only need 45% of these licenses, please can we cancel them and have some of our money back? Or is it a case of you need to wait till renewal and kind of, you know, go through that process at that point? I think that's probably for you, Dean.
Unfortunately, Rich, the devil's in the details on that one. And there's no blanket statement that's going to work for everybody, because there's a lot that has to be considered. I think most customers aren't just going to pick up everything that they have on-prem and drop it into Azure on one day and just, you know, alleviate all of their licensing needs on-prem and move them into Azure. So one thing that customers have to be aware of is that migration time, right? I think for an average customer, you're probably looking at 6 months to move an application across, easily a year or 18 months to move everything over in there. And so how are you gonna manage that from a licensing perspective? So there's the migration time that comes into it. And then there's also the cost optimization, the license optimization time. And that can also be tricky to handle. There are ways where you can have it done where, you know, once you're moved into Azure, you get the cost savings on day one. You go from, you know, 100 licenses needed to 40, and you only have to pay Oracle for those 40. There's other scenarios where it might be at the renewal time where you have to negotiate and work through that to realize those. But oftentimes when you look at it, one thing I often point out is that not even factoring the new 8% cost increase in support, but if you're paying 22% a year for your support on those licenses, every 4 years you're rebuying the licenses. So if you look at these things in kind of a medium-term window of 3 to 5 years, it can have a significant impact on your cost, depending on how you get that restructured.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think, you know, one thing that we talk to our audience about a lot is, you know, as infrastructure becomes more cloud-based, more hybrids, you know, in some organizations, you know, IT asset management, software asset management, procurement even, are sometimes left out of these decisions until right near the end. You know, they kind of go, right, we've been working, you know, for the last 15 months, this is what's happening, can you just check that all the software is okay? And we're sort of saying that, you know, more and more in this hybrid world, having asset management involved sooner is better for everyone. You know, and maybe, you know, IT asset management aren't necessarily a technical discipline in terms of they won't be deciding some of these how much resource you need, but I think they absolutely need to be part of the conversation so that they can say, well, Dean, if you make that change, that's going to mean we need to renegotiate X, Y, and Z, and that's going to take 2 years, or we categorically can't do this for 18 months. So I think what you were saying there is a fantastic example of how asset management working together with architecture, design, cloud center of excellence, in these kind of scenarios is really key. But I think there's, you know, we've touched on quite a few things. There are, you know, we've been talking about running Oracle in cloud. Oracle is not a monolith. There are, you know, different products, different types. So I think one thing to specifically touch on is running Oracle wrapped. And I guess probably, you know, a quick overview of what that is for people who might be not be familiar, And then, yeah, looking at how that plays into the Azure piece as well.
That's a great point, Rich, because Oracle Rack is a key component for a lot of customers. So for those that might not be aware, that's Oracle Real Application Clusters. It is a high availability technology that Oracle offers. It's a paid for option in addition to your enterprise edition databases that allows you to essentially create a very large number of databases clustered together in there. And it can be is often used for some of customers' most critical databases that can basically never go down in there. a lot of confusion around that on the technical and licensing side. I'll let Tim touch on the technical piece of running that in Rack and some of the issues he's seen. And then I'll talk a little bit about the licensing support and contractual side.
Sure. Well, one thing just to, I guess, cover it quite frankly, is that Oracle support has stated that they do not support Rack in cloud environments other than Oracle Cloud, period. So there's that. As a result, Microsoft doesn't recommend the use of Oracle Rack in Azure at all. That's point number one. Point number two is that Azure Cloud doesn't support Azure Cloud, generic Azure Cloud doesn't support multicast networking. And that's an important part of Rack itself. So just installing Rack in Azure Cloud itself by itself, you know, won't work. So that's the second thing. There's some additional software support that needs to be added to support multicasting. So when customers come to Azure and they want to use Rack, we have to ask why. There's two reasons for using Rack. There's the high availability reason, and then there's the scalability reason. In other words, the original reason for building Rack back in the 1980s, why Oracle designed Rack, was for scalability. In other words, the back in the 1980s, systems were single uniprocessor systems, and if your database workload exceeded that size, you needed to be able to somehow either build a bigger system or somehow lash together two or three or four of them, and that's how Rack was born, lashing together two or three or four systems together. And that's still the case. If the database workload exceeds the size of a single VM in Azure, then you need to lash together two or three or four of them. Without Rack, we can't do that. So that scalability use case, if your database workload exceeds the size of the largest VM in Azure, you can't run it in Azure, is what it comes down to. Now, the high availability use case, the other one, and which is far more common, the scalability use case I found literally is fewer than the fingers on my one hand that I've run across, where we've said we can't accommodate your database workload because there are some very large VMs in Azure. So the high availability use case, when you get right down to it, this is going to be controversial, but I'll just go right out and say it. There are several high availability and data protection mechanisms that Oracle offers. Mechanisms like Rack, like DataGuard, like GoldenGate. And if you stop and think about it, you can argue, and if you consider it, you can argue that Rack is really perhaps the third most effective HA and data protection mechanism that Oracle offers, with DataGuard and GoldenGate being either one or two, number one or number two. And I would argue that DataGuard is the most effective and cost-effective data protection and high availability mechanism that Oracle offers. So for that reason, for high availability, we recommend using Oracle DataGuard as opposed to Oracle Rack for high availability in Azure. So we do recommend changing the method of high availability used over to DataGuard as opposed to Rack for our customers. And given that there are now more than 5,000 Azure customers running Oracle, and a significant number of those formerly ran Rack on-prem, and now they're running in Azure. It's been a good choice. So
I think that's a great technical summary. And as a former Oracle Rack DBA, I agree with that. There's a lot of reasons that you might want to move away from Rack, from the care and feeding it takes, from the maintenance, from the performance impact of Rack itself. Even though you do get that scalability, it comes at a cost, the price. There's a lot of reasons in there. From a contractual perspective and a licensing perspective, though, I want to help customers be clear that they can run Rack in Microsoft Azure. It does require some technical workarounds at this time to make it work. But from a contractual perspective, there is nothing that prohibits you from installing Oracle database and Rack software in Azure that prevents you from patching Oracle database and Rack software in Azure, licensing it properly. Again, one of the key things is right-sizing your environment. So right-size that too to stay in compliance with the licensing in there. And then do that as you see fit. And we have some customers who are running Rack in clouds. They've a lot of customers who are looking at maybe moving off of Oracle support for reasons, considering third-party support, and that becomes an option in there too. And so having that capability, having that ability to deploy it if you so choose, I think is an important one to note. Although I think I agree with Tim fully that it is a little bit of a be careful what you wish for on that, because there is some overhead to it in there from an operational side and a technical side.
Yeah, we do have customers running Rimini Street support, and we also have customers in Azure running FlashGrid with Oracle Rack.
Yep. So two good choices out there, but yeah, there are some reasons in there. And one of the confusing pieces that comes up is the ability to do it in the first place. And that one, I hope customers take away from this, that they are able to run Rack. There are some caveats around it, but you can move your Oracle Rack databases into Azure as well.
Yeah. I think that's really important and interesting, Dean, that, yeah, there's a difference between, you know, what you can and can't do and what you should do. And I think this is perhaps a great example, but, you know, there are some customer organizations out there that have got, you know, immense Oracle database skills in-house. And, you know, if you're capable and it ticks all the boxes, knowing that you are allowed to is important. But I think equally for other organizations, I think we've done quite a good job of putting some people off thinking about this idea, probably in terms of, you know, yeah, it might be possible, but, you know, it's there are lots of things which are possible, but they're not doable. And for some organizations, I've come to learn over the last 35 minutes that this is probably one of those things for a lot of customers. So I'm conscious of time. We're going to have to kind of wrap this up. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I think for some people listening, it's perhaps going to give them additional questions. You know, in which case, you know, feel free to get in touch with any or all of us via email, LinkedIn, etc. If you do have questions, I mean, you know, I know we'll be talking again at some point about the wonderful world of Oracle. So, you know, if there are things that people ask us, we can cover them, you know, either directly or on a future session or something. So yeah, you know, thank you to both of you. It's been very interesting. A pleasure as always. You know, very thankful for your time. So thank you, Dean, and thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Rich, and thank you to all the listeners out there. We appreciate you taking the time to sit through this.
Absolutely. Yeah, hopefully it's made your commute or, you know, the hoovering, whatever it is that people do when they listen to podcasts these days, now that working from home is so prevalent. Hopefully it's made that a little bit more enjoyable. So yeah, thank you to both of you. Thank you to all the listeners, and I will catch you all on the next one. See you soon.